From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the deep freeze and the blackout that gripped Texas was deadly, but how deadly was it? That number that the state has could be significantly too low. A church that worships with AR-15 assault rifles is setting up a massive compound near Waco. And what can we learn about the state of America's democracy by looking at the rise of Hitler? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. It was 100 days ago that many of us in Texas were shivering in the dark. The historic winter storm was too cold and lasted too long for natural gas providers. Their wellheads and pipelines froze. That's the main reason why the grid failed and why people died. But how many people died? 100 days later, that question is still being answered. Certainly, the state of Texas has its official number, 151 dead, and that's a tragic number of deaths. But recent analysis demonstrates that this could be a undercount, and that the actual number of dead is significantly higher. Zara Hergy is one of the reporters on a team from BuzzFeed News that looked at the death records and medical examiner's reports during the Texas winter storm Uri.
The official death count is 151. In our analysis, and by that I really mean the work done by my colleague Peter Aldis, looked at how many more people died during and immediately after the storm than would have been expected. This is called an excess death analysis, and it's been used to, say, better understand the full toll of COVID-19, or how many people actually died from Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. And so according to our best estimate, around 700 people or so were likely killed by the storm during the worst week with the power outages.
And when you say they were killed by the storm, these are people who may have had other conditions. They were getting along fine. They were able to get their dialysis. They had their oxygen tanks. They were able to manage their lives well. But it was the disruption of so many of these systems that we rely on that resulted in deaths?
Yeah. And so, you know, I guess when I meant to say caused by the storm, it's really the storm and the related power outages and just the disruption that the event caused. Many of these uncounted victims, as you already mentioned, were medically vulnerable. These were people with chronic conditions, including cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and kidney problems. And we know this kind of because the deaths themselves, we saw an actual spike in, say, the number of people that had died from those causes. But then pairing that with scientific literature and our conversations with medical examiners, you know, we know that environments like the storm can cause a lot of stress, physical stress. Think about the cold, emotional stress. And so for people that are already medically vulnerable, it can really push them over the edge.
So there are two big takeaways from this reporting. One of them is that so many more people died, lost their lives from the catastrophe of the storm and the power outage. And then the other takeaway is Texas does a really bad job of counting people who died during these type of events. Is that right?
Yeah, I think this really exposes how confusing and tricky it is to count these deaths. You know, only 12 counties in Texas, which has many counties, have medical examiners in the first place, which are the ones that generally would kind of review these cases. And then for the places that have medical examiners, you know, we found cases from our reporting, talking with families, that there were often discrepancies between how a family would describe that their loved one, whether it was their brother, their wife, their husband, their mom, died, the conditions that they died in, and then what actually made it into the notes for their cases that were reviewed by medical examiners.
So I know y'all did a lot of detailed analysis looking at these reports, and But can you just look at the baseline number of deaths that we would typically have in mid-February and then compare that to the number of deaths that we had in February of 2021? And then that you would see that there are a lot more deaths during this time than the 151 that the state of Texas has so far acknowledged. It really should leap out at you like this was something else is happening here.
I mean, that is part of what this analysis looks at. Obviously, you know, a big thing that has happened over the last 2 years has been COVID-19. And with this analysis, we had specifically stripped out COVID-19 deaths so that we know the spike we're looking at was not contributed by the pandemic. And another reason why we feel so secure in our analysis is it wasn't just done for Texas. We looked at the surrounding area. You know, a huge swath of the U.S. was really impacted by this winter storm. And we did not see a spike in deaths in those surrounding states. It was really only seen in Texas, which was the one that suffered these days-long power outages.
So it seems like anyone who bothered to look at this data, this information, it was there to be seen. But still, Texas only acknowledges 151 winter storm deaths. And I have to wonder about that. Texas, they have this data. This is where it comes from, that they could have been able to provide these numbers.
You know, we reached out to the Texas Health Department of Human Services, to the governor, and the health officials did not respond at all. The governor didn't respond specifically to our analysis and our findings, but we would love to get to hear what they have to say.
If the state of Texas sticks by this number of 151, does that seem like a willful ignorance of the facts that have been determined?
I mean, that number just isn't right. And I think what we saw with Hurricane Maria, for example, is it took a lot of calls and people pointing out and doing this basically identical type of analysis to expose what the true death toll was. And it took a while, but eventually the officials there did acknowledge that the toll had been and was much higher than they were initially saying. And I think it's an open question about whether that will happen in Texas.
Zara Herjee is a science and energy reporter for BuzzFeed News. She was part of a team that compiled data and conducted an analysis of the fatalities of the Texas winter storm Uri and found that the official Texas death count of 151 is inaccurate. They estimate that the real number should be about 700. A pro-Trump religious sect known for worshiping with AR-15s and other firearms has found fertile ground in Texas for attracting new followers. The Sanctuary Church is also known as the Iron Rod Ministries, recently purchased 40 acres in central Texas and is preparing for what they see as an imminent war against the so-called deep state. It's near the town of Thornton, 40 miles from Waco in Limestone County. Tess Owen is a reporter with Vice News.
The Rod of Iron Ministries, aka Sanctuary Church, they sort of formed in 2017 by Hyungjin Sean Moon, who is the son of Reverend Sun Young Moon, who is a self-proclaimed Messiah, accused cult leader, who was the head of the Unification Church, whose followers became known by outsiders as Moonies. And so his son formed a spin-off originally in Pennsylvania and sort of more or less follows his father's teachings, but with a twist because there are AR-15s that figure prominently in the teachings and in the church itself. So like his father or like the Unification Church, they have, for example, mass wedding ceremonies. In this case, there are still mass wedding ceremonies, but with AR-15s.
The original Moonies, that was the World Unification Church, not a Christian faith. But we have now Pastor Sean Moon. He walks around with this crown of bullets around his head. And he has he like adopted parts of the Christian faith? And then he's cobbled in pro-Trump talking points and QAnon conspiracy theories into what he is now delivering from the pulpit.
Exactly. He has a sort of gold-plated AR-15 that he displays before him when he's delivering his sermons. And sort of increasingly, he has also adopted a bit of a sort of biker gang aesthetic as well. He used to be kind of wearing a camouflage blazer with the crown, and now he's sort of wearing a biker jacket.
The church has acquired property in Central Texas near Waco. Now, that should send up some red flags in and of itself, because we've seen this movie before, and it was called The Branch Davidians. Should we be concerned about that they're on those same tracks?
You know, I don't want to speculate, obviously, but we have seen in the past that when you combine this kind of intense rhetoric that I've been seeing, which is sometimes, you know, takes on a very apocalyptic tone. The pastor was telling his followers that they should be prepared to die for the cause. And that was just prior to January 6th. Pastor Moon was at the Capitol. He didn't go inside the Capitol as far as I can tell, but he did post videos of himself at the Capitol running from tear gas. And since then, the tone has taken kind of increasingly militant. So when you combine that, you combine, I guess, former members of the church had told me that historically the Unification Church as well sort of relied on quite coercive tactics to try and sort of foster enduring loyalty, unhealthy attitudes towards mental health, and then guns. Yeah, I think that is a pretty dangerous combination. So yeah, I can see why people, and also the fact that this place, Liberty Rock, this site that they've acquired, is 40 miles from Waco. So I can definitely see the, you know, why you'd want to draw those comparisons.
And there are some Trump officials who have become close to this church as well, Steve Bannon being one of them. How are they cross-pollinating? What's their interaction like?
Pastor Moon's father, Reverend Sun Myung Moon, he historically sought out legitimacy by kind of trying to build alliances on the fringes of the GOP. And that was like 70s and 80s. So that meant like, you know, holding a rally for Nixon amid the Watergate scandal, or pouring millions of dollars into, quote, conservative causes like anti-communist lobbying efforts for CPAC. I think that Pastor Moon is kind of following in his father's footsteps in that way. But the fringes of the GOP are much, much fringier today than perhaps they were back then. So, you know, that's meant sort of diving headfirst in some of these conspiracy theories, sort of dabbling in QAnon, you know, building alliances with, you know, Stop the Steal. So I think as well, through the Second Amendment advocacy, he's been able to establish some alliances in that world as well.
Anti-communist China is also a major part of their platform, their talking points, that they stand with Trump in fighting against communist China. Why is that important?
Well, the idea of political Satanism, quote, political Satanism, is something that plays quite heavily in his sermons. And from what I can at least tell, political Satanism is basically any kind of politics that he doesn't like. So that might be communist China. And also, I mean, his father was from Korea and founded the church in Korea in the 1950s. So there's a whole history there as well. But I think and his father was also very, very anti-communist. But I think now it sort of plays into just overall rhetoric. So, you know, Antifa, Democrats, communists, China, it just sort of all gets rolled into the same kind of word salad and conspiracy theories that also end up containing echoes of like QAnon and things like that.
Is the local government and where this compound is, the county government or any local municipality, are they aware of what's going on? Should they be concerned? We've seen events in the past where a cult compound will become involved in local politics and try and take over school boards and run for political office. And there's a lot of violent rhetoric coming from the church right now, saying that there's going to be a war. It's one thing to have a compound and you guys stay in your compound and everything's fine and you guys, you know, have your beliefs, but when has it become a concern for the greater good?
I mean, that's a great question. I did reach out to kind of people who seem to be community organizers in this town. And I think, yeah, people are definitely concerned about their new neighbors. I know that some of them have contacted local law enforcement just to give them a heads up. But I think it's kind of, it's quite early days. I mean, at the moment, they've only, I mean, I think they had a ribbon cutting ceremony for this property about a month ago. And there's a GoFundMe currently for renovations. So it's still quite early days and it's not entirely clear how many members of the church are going to be living there. They did say that they hoped it will be home to 100 sites for, quote, patriots and supporters of the church. So I guess it's going to, we sort of have to wait and see how that plays out.
Tess Owen is a reporter with Vice News. She is tracking the Sanctuary Church, also known as the Iron Rod Ministries, where the congregation is told to be heavily armed and its leader preaches a pro-Trump end-of-the-world doctrine. They are building a compound near Waco. How fragile is American democracy and how close was it to cracking on January 6th when a pro-Trump mob stormed the Capitol to, quote, stop the steal? It's impossible to know right now how significant this eruption is in American history. Is this the Whiskey Rebellion or is it Fort Sumter? That depends on what happens next. But historian Benjamin Carter Hett says there are frightening similarities to where we are in America today and where Germany was in 1923 as Adolf Hitler worked to end that democracy.
Germany in the 20s and 30s was a really sophisticated, in many ways, very humane country. And the fact that it could produce this incredibly barbaric regime has the quality of a permanent warning, I think. I mean, in a sense, it's a way of saying we ought not to assume that we are immune to such things. Democracy failed in Germany at that time, and Hitler succeeded basically because a lot of powerful groups, notably big business and the high command of the armed forces, decided that democracy just wasn't working for them. Their interests just would not be covered by democracy. So they actively wanted to move the democratic system rightwards into an authoritarian system in which they would have more control and their interests would be protected. And for several years, they did a kind of awkward dance with Hitler because they didn't really like Hitler or his movement. He and his movement were too radical for them. But they recognized that in some ways there was a fit. He was nationalist. He was pro-militarist. He was certainly anti-democratic and certainly anti-left. And so eventually, and again, this was a complicated process, but over about a three-year period or so of this awkward dance, they concluded that the powerful elites concluded that they could use Hitler and his movement to back them. And they arranged a deal, basically, whereby Hitler came into power as chancellor with the backing of the traditional right. And then, you know, spoiler alert, it didn't actually work out that well for the people who had backed him and put him there because Hitler turned out to be much more dangerous than they had anticipated.
It's not cool to make comparisons to Nazi Germany. And we've seen that now with the Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene saying, you know, masks and vaccines are like the Holocaust. And anytime you say, well, it's like, you know, Hitler, it means you've lost your argument. But that doesn't mean that there aren't things that we can learn from the fall of democracy in that time and how there are comparisons and there are differences between where we are today.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think it's important to keep the nuance here. And, you know, Congresswoman Green is not a good one for nuance. I mean, her comparison, after all, the Nazis put stars on people as a step towards killing them, whereas vaccine is to save lives. So, I mean, one need say no more about that. But, when Donald Trump was elected to president, there was a lot of sort of superficial talk about how he was like Hitler. And that's ridiculous because as a person, Trump bears just about no relationship, you know, no similarity to Adolf Hitler. But the thing I would say, and the thing that I tried to sort of bring out, especially in my book, The Death of Democracy, is that there are some structural parallels between us now and them then that are a bit worrying. And in particular, I think the fact that important segments of German society then, important conservative segments, were willing to conclude that democracy wasn't working for them and were willing to move away from it and were willing to move to authoritarian solutions is, I'm afraid to say, something we are seeing a bit now too. And that is certainly worrying. You know, there's a phrase that is used nowadays a lot, the guardrails of democracy, the kind of mostly unwritten rules about how the game of democracy is played, of which maybe the most important is that for a democracy to work, one side has to be willing to lose. The side that loses an election has to accept its loss. And to put it mildly, we are not seeing that right now. And that is deeply worrying.
So we could just distill it down to the very essence. If there's one thing that most people should be take away from this comparison, is that just because you are a democracy today doesn't mean that you will be one tomorrow. Things can change.
That's exactly right. Things can change, and things can change depending on what we do and how we act. And, you know, democracy depends ultimately on all of us, in a sense, agreeing that the well-being of the community, and in particular the well-being of our democracy, depends that we put that first, ultimately, and our own preferences, perhaps our own interests, second. And once, you know, any significant segment of society starts deciding, as powerful Germans did, you know, 80 or so years ago, well, no, my interests come first and the democracy is at best second or maybe irrelevant, then you are heading towards real danger. And, you know, that is grounds for concern. I also, you know, I also do like to sort of stress the other side of the point, though, and that I'm not trying to suggest here that, you know, we're in Weimar America right now or anything like that, because there are significant differences.
The thing is, we don't know where we are on the timeline of history, what's happening. And this is something that you bring up in your work, that there were events that brought about the rise of Nazi Germany, end of democracy there. We don't know where we are with the January 6th insurgency, the storming of the Capitol. And we won't know because until it's too late. The fall of democracy is like a trap, and you don't know that you're in a trap until it's been sprung. So how do we make sense of where we are in the timeline?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good point. And, you know, we live forward and history is thought about backwards. So, you know, it's exactly right that we don't quite know where we are. And history is always an imperfect guide, because when you're trying to figure out from history what might happen next, it's always an analogy which is never going to quite fit. And it depends what part of the analogy you focus on. That said, I have put forward the view, I wrote a piece in the LA Times after January 6th happened, suggesting that as awful as January 6th was, in my view, it's not really the scariest thing, in the sense that those people who stormed the Capitol could have been dangerous, in the sense that they certainly could have killed a lot of people. They could have killed more people than they did. Mercifully, that didn't happen. But that event then and there, in my view, was not a danger to the survival of the democratic system in America. Those people could not have destroyed our democracy. You really can only destroy a democracy. You can only overturn a state, which is a huge, complex thing. You can really only do that from inside. So this is a good news, bad news thing. It means that as awful as January 6th was, I'm certainly not trying to really downplay it, but it wasn't a threat to our democracy in the way that other things that are happening now are. Because, you know, we do see now people who are inside the system. We see people who are in state legislatures, you know, in particular recently, doing their level best to limit access to voting, to even make it possible for state legislatures to overturn election outcomes, you know, if you get a majority in favor of that. This is really worrying, because that is how a democracy can be endangered. And so to me, the sort of takeaway from all this is that we need to focus on the things that are really an ongoing threat into the future to the safety of our democratic system.
Another issue where we don't know where we are in the timeline moving forward is the Biden administration, the Democratic Party in control of the House and barely in control of the Senate. They could use this opportunity, and the clock is ticking down to November 2022. There probably will be a change in control of the House. they could use this time now to strengthen those guardrails of democracy.
I think that's the single highest priority. I wish President Biden would push that legislation a lot harder, because to me, if he passes nothing else in the year and a half or so before the midterms, that's the crucial thing. That's the absolutely crucial thing, in my view.
And that's why we may need to have a January 6th commission, not only to understand the timeline of that day, not only understand why it took so long for troops to arrive and rescue our lawmakers, but trying to figure out who in Congress may have actually provided resources and intelligence and what the objectives were that day. We don't know. I mean, I don't know if democracy could have fallen that day. I don't know if those were just a bunch of hooligans just trying to break windows and defecate on the halls of Congress. But how would we know if we don't have a commission?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. And I think, you know, you mentioned the question of who in Congress may have really been implicated in this, who in the administration, you know, may really have been implicated in this or facilitating it. To me, those are the really important questions, because that's the kind of thing that's dangerous going forward. And I agree completely. That's the kind of thing that we need to know. And I agree completely that needs to be investigated. The model of a 9/11 style commission would be ideal. It's extremely telling that so many Republicans don't want that. Of course they don't want it, because they know it's going to implicate them. You know, it's just that simple.
Some people are saying we're in a civil war already, right now. You'll hear that from Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz. What is this civil war about? And it seems to be about Trumpism, making Trump the president again. That would mean what? At the end of multiracial democracy in America, installing him, I guess, as a permanent president. Is that what this is about?
That may be what it's about. It may even not so much be about Trump as about the broader thing that, you know, ultimately, I think support for Trump and support for the things he represents. I've thought about this a lot. It seems to me it really boils down to race. You know, it really boils down to there's a segment of the country that just absolutely does not want to live in a multiracial democracy. And when supporters of Trump say, oh, he tells it like it is, you know, obviously a man who lies so extraordinarily often doesn't tell it like it is. But what they're saying is really a kind of code for saying he says the racist things that they sort of know they can't say but wish they could. And he's kind of made it okay to say really racist things again in the service of what is, quite frankly, a pretty straight out white supremacist agenda. So ultimately, I think that's what it's about. You know, if we are heading towards some kind of civil war, maybe, or at least civil disturbance and so on, I think ultimately you boil it down, it comes down to a clash between white supremacy and a more multiracial, inclusive democracy.
Benjamin Carter Hett is a professor of history at Hunter College and at the City University of New York, and the author of several books, including Burning the Reichstag, An Investigation into the Third Reich's Enduring Mystery, and The Death of Democracy, Hitler's Rise to Power and the Downfall of the Weimar Republic. His newest book is The Nazi Menace, Hitler, Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin, and the Road to War. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past episodes of Texas Matters to listen to, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.